You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Obama and Congress are grappling with many complex problems: high unemployment, a fragile recovery from a deep recession, health care, climate change, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a crumbling infrastructure. Considering the long track record of good policies gone bad through wasteful spending and ineffective measures, it's easy to understand why many Americans are cynical about the ability of government to fix those problems. But a new book by William D. Eggers and John O'Leary called If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government, maps out the enormous successes of past administrations and suggests ways that this government can get it right the first time. It's published by Harvard Business Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings William D. Eggers and John O'Leary to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be with you this morning.
You write that only 23% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing. Have Americans always been this cynical, or is this something that goes back, I would guess, in my lifetime, to the Vietnam War?
Well, it's interesting. That's actually...
This is Bill Eggers.
Yeah, this is Bill Eggers. The reason why we called our book If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, and with the ellipses at the end, was because that phrase, that it didn't start off as a cliche. Of course, it started off as a challenge issued by John F. Kennedy. And in the first 10 years or so after we put a man on the moon, it was mostly used as a phrase in order to show, look, we can do anything as Americans, anything we want. But, you know, then towards the end of the Carter years and others, it started morphing into more of a sign of frustration with government and disappointment that if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we fix our schools? Why can't we end poverty and so forth? And so the book was about it's really about those two sides of that.
Well, you look into all of the reasons that we wind up having problems. In October, the General Accounting Office released an audit that found in five large states alone around 65,000 instances of people improperly obtaining potentially addictive drugs at a cost to the taxpayer of around $65 million, including thousands of prescriptions written for dead patients or by people posing as doctors. So as Congress debates health care reform, this audit hardly inspires confidence. What should the government be doing in order to more carefully monitor the prescription benefit?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what they should be doing in that particular instance, but I think what we need to be doing is taking very seriously, much more seriously than we do now, the process by which we undertake large undertakings. We tend to focus on the policy. What should we do? And what goal are we hoping to achieve? But we don't tend to look at the overall process that takes us from an idea through a legislative design, getting it passed into law, and then implementing it, and then seeing if we're actually getting the results that we were hoping for. And programs such as the one you just mentioned, as well as numerous others, from No Child Left Behind to a number of others, have created very disappointing results in the past.
Well, how much of this is just bad execution? For example, the Bernard Madoff case, where he said that they were just incompetent, that they should have caught him a long time ago.
Well, look, some of it is...
The laws are in place.
Yeah. Well, some of it is bad execution, but actually what we found was that the root of so many of these big problems actually lie in the legislative design, that they were designed to get through city council, to get through Congress, as opposed to work in the real world. And people added all these goodies to them and everything, and then the pieces didn't fit together. I mean, think about our decades-long quest for energy independence. It's like Groundhog Day, right? Every new president signs a bill saying we're going to have energy independence by X year, and we're going to get all of our energy from the sun, and we keep on becoming more and more dependent. And so we're in a situation where we end up celebrating a victory essentially after passing a bill, and no one's kind of waiting around to see, okay, is this going to work 4 or 5 years, 10 years down the road?
In this book, you've studied over 75 major initiatives since World War II. It actually might be a good idea to start off with some of the successes. The Marshall Plan. You cite the Marshall Plan as a great success. What about the design and execution made it such a good example of public policy?
Well, one of the things that happened with the Marshall Plan was that it was announced by Secretary of State Marshall at a speech at Harvard, commencement speech at Harvard. And when it was initially raised, it wasn't terribly popular. It was going to be an expensive proposition for a nation, the United States, coming out of a war, World War II. But over a period of 10 months, the case was made to the American public as to why this was so important for the political stability of Europe. And by the time the Marshall Plan passed 10 months later, it was a popular idea. It was also the case that both sides of the aisles, Democrats and Republicans, worked together to get agreement on how to approach it. And they also put some very, very top people. They were able to attract very top talent to the actual execution to go to Europe and actually do the disbursement of aid. So through all phases of the project, from the idea to the legislative design to the actual execution, there was attention paid to the process. And it worked, and it's been a very, very successful program.
And it was done efficiently?
Yeah, I mean, it
because
was...
Because so many times when money is involved, quite a bit of it disappears down some sinkhole.
Yeah, there's been almost no... none of that with the Marshall Plan. And in fact, you know, if you look at the goodwill that it managed to bring the United States, and that's true of a number of things from, you know, the GI Bill to building the national highway system to restoring democracy in Japan. That was a very, very big challenge, and it was done successfully, relatively quietly.
And as Bill pointed out, putting a man on the moon. President Kennedy challenged the country to put a man on the moon in 1961, and 8 years later, we were there.
And, you know, we write about the man who actually was very responsible for the execution of that was a guy named James Webb. And James Webb was the...
Not the senator from Virginia.
No, James Webb was essentially the bureaucrat, the long-term civil servant who Kennedy brought in. He was the head of NASA. And he was the guy who actually had to make all this happen. I mean, it was a huge challenge. They had tens of thousands of contractors and universities involved. We'd never done anything like this. It was a fairly tight time frame. But Webb was a master at working both through all the political issues, but also all the bureaucratic issues. What we found in this book was that one of the key to successes is having these bridgers, these people who can bridge between the bureaucratic world and the political world.
So this brings us up to 1970, and then things start to fall apart. Now, why weren't all of these successes that you described over the previous 15 years, 15 years?
25 years, roughly, end of World War II, yeah.
Why were they no longer role models?
Well, you know, it's pretty clear that we surveyed senior
public
officials.
You see, you shouldn't put me in charge of any of these things because of my math.
Something definitely happened in the sense that the 1970s brought us Watergate, wage and price controls, and another tool to try to fight inflation, whip inflation now buttons. I mean, completely ridiculous major right. public program launched by President Ford. High inflation during Carter, the Iran hostage crisis. And it definitely was a huge black eye to government. And you were talking earlier about the levels of cynicism. I think that those of us over a certain age of 40 plus grew up in an environment where America could do no wrong. We were the country that won World War II, and we split the atom with the Manhattan Project and on put a man on the moon. And then came the Vietnam War and Watergate and all these challenges. And I think that today you're seeing probably the highest levels of cynicism and lack of confidence toward government than we've ever seen.
Were those failures of leadership in the White House? After all, we're talking about Nixon, Ford, and Carter, and a Congress that was pretty much controlled by the Democratic Party that seemed to be able to do whatever it wanted to do.
Well, I think that one of the things we argue very strongly in the book is that when we see something that doesn't work out well, the natural human tendency is to blame someone. Oftentimes the person who's in charge or the president or what have you. And we argue that there are actually systemic forces, challenges that make getting stuff done in the public sector extremely difficult. And it's almost as though the string of successes that we had from the end of World War II till the late 60s was almost an aberration. And we really need to be more realistic about what we ask government to do and the expectation that we're going to have challenges if we try to do something very, very big.
My guests are John O'Leary, a research fellow at the Ash Institute of the Harvard Kennedy School, and William D. Eggers, global director of Deloitte's Public Sector Research Program. This is at WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, let's talk about some of the traps you say that we fall into. One of them is the Tolstoy trap. Now, I would think the Tolstoy trap would mean... writing a great novel. I'd love to fall into that
trap. Writer's block. No. You know, we the Tolstoy trap is commonly also known as confirmation bias. And that's when you look at only evidence that confirms your view of the world and you let ideology get in the way of what works. And, you know, look at our society today where you have large segments of the population will only watch Fox News and the other segments will watch MSNBC and they go to their own websites and everything. And everyone essentially goes to places to have their views confirmed as opposed to being informed. And that actually has a lot of problems in terms of executing these big initiatives, because if you don't have a good idea to start with, and if the idea is biased because you can't take diverse viewpoints in, then you're going to fail. I mean, and look at what happened in Iraq, and I think that's it's a really good example of that.
Well, the President Bush has been accused of falling into the Tolstoy trap quite a bit, but now we have a president who seems to always want to wants to split everything down the middle. Is that any better? It's not confirmation bias.
It's actually, we don't think this is about splitting things down the middle. It's about opening your ideas up to criticism from others and basically taking in a diversity of viewpoints. It doesn't just mean people in the other party, but it means listening to engineers and scientists and others. So when you look at the approach to Afghanistan here, you know, President Obama, from everything I've read, he basically asked a lot of tough questions. They did a lot of scenario planning. They did a lot of war gaming on whether this would work or not. And they tried to take ideas from a variety of sources. We looked at a whole bunch of initiatives, and a lot of the very successful ones were an example of reaching across the ideological boundary.
Well, critics would say that even though there were devil's advocates in the White House on the team, in the end, the decision is what everybody expected it to be from the very beginning. So, I think the very first day before we had all of these meetings and everything, we were hearing 30 to 40,000 troops, a surge, and pretty much everything that we now have come to hear from the president is his new plan.
Yeah, it may be a while before we come to see exactly what the internal processes really were that took place. But I think it's clear that, in contrast, that the decisions around Iraq were, and particularly around Iraq reconstruction, there were those who were saying within the Bush administration that, boy, Iraq reconstruction is going to take a lot more time, a lot more money, a lot more troops than our plan is calling for. And those voices were shut off in the Bush White House. So I don't know about the decision-making per se in Afghanistan, but I think that it's pretty clear now that that idea of confirmation bias, of only being open to hearing ideas that support your view, it was definitely a trap that the Bush administration fell into in the Iraq situation.
A listener asks, does the ineffectiveness of government coincide with the rise of corporations and corporate power in our country?
I don't think so. And I want to just make sure that we preface this, but to say that we are not saying that. I mean, there's actually been a lot of public policy successes in the last 20 years. I mean, we're right here in New York City, and the crime rate has been reduced by 60% or so. The number of people on the welfare rolls has plummeted. We've seen some great successes. Acid rain, which was a huge problem in the Northeast 30 years ago, is no longer a problem. We've reduced sulfur dioxide by 40%. So we've actually achieved some great things over the last 30 years. It's easy to forget those and miss Katrina and Iraq.
And the Big Dig.
But we have had successes, and there's common elements to those successes and those failures.
We'll be back with some of those common elements, pro and con, as we continue this conversation with William D. Eggers and John O'Leary. Their book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government, it is published by Harvard Business Press. Stay with us. We're back with William D. Eggers, Global Director of Deloitte's Public Sector Research Program, and John O'Leary, a research fellow at the Ash Institute of the Harvard Kennedy School. They have collaborated on a book called If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. It's published by Harvard Business Press. And I mentioned the Big Dig because that seems to be perhaps the worst example of how everything can go wrong. Why?
Well, there were several factors that took place on the Big Dig. It was initially estimated to be a project that would be funded 90% by the federal government and cost about $3 billion. And by the time things were completed, it cost over $15 billion. And more importantly, it had leaks. There was a widespread corruption issues in terms of contractors and others had built the system.
One of the panels fell and killed somebody.
And the tunnel, one of the tunnels actually collapsed and killed a woman driving on her way to the airport. And I think that that has really focused people's attention on, boy, you know, how can we fail to build something really straightforward like this? And what we argue in the book is that whenever something goes wrong like that, the natural human instinct is to blame a person. And we looked at the systems, and we think that there was a lot of systems that were in place that led to that. And the biggest being was that the local government there was spending federal dollars overwhelmingly. So there was very little in the way of cost control measures and others. And
they had probably no incentive to even bother.
Right. There was no incentives. And the other was that the strength of the sort of the public construction companies and unions, it sort of everybody was benefiting from having the cost go up except for the taxpayers. But the main taxpayers who were getting hit were the ones who lived in, you know, Idaho and Nevada, at least initially. As things eventually turned out, more than half the cost ended up being on Massachusetts taxpayers because the overruns were so great that the federal government eventually turned off the funding at about $8 or $9 billion. But it is a very, very sobering example. And it also, I think, is an example of probably reaching too far. What the project they were looking to do was an incredibly complex engineering feat. It was digging under an existing city, taking down roads. It was much more difficult than, say, laying highway. And if people
a reason that we should be concerned about a Second Avenue subway system?
I think any time you're looking at major public infrastructure in dense areas, you need to be concerned about overreach. And I think that that is one of the things that concerns me now, is that in a lot of cases, government does tend to overreach if they're using, particularly if they're using funding sources that aren't local. If people aren't paying for things locally, it does encourage cost overruns.
Well, sometimes people just don't think of consequences. For example, here in New York on Canal Street, they were redoing the Canal Street subway station, and a building fell because they undermined its foundation without even realizing that they were doing that. People died as a result.
Yeah, anytime I think you do, and this is true in the private sector as well as the public sector, anytime you try to do something big and significant, you do run risks of failure. And one of the things that occurs in the political realm is that our political leaders tend not to talk in terms of caution or prudence or, hey, you know what, we're going to try this, but it might not work. Any politician who's trying to sell a program is over the top confident and bold.
Failure is not an option.
Failure is not an option.
In fact, you say overconfidence right. is one of the seven traps.
And it's actually one of the traps that initiatives fell into more than any other one, essentially. And it's this notion, this overconfidence in the political realm, this kind of congenital optimism that proves very problematic. What we say is the best way to avoid failure is to take failure really, really seriously.
So when we look at the Iraq War, we see that as a perfect example of overconfidence without a plan B.
Right, right. You know, what the public sector often does is it fails at scale, essentially, where things get so big and then they get too big to fail, right? And what we need to be doing a lot more of, and this is what the great Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who we profile in the book, was always talking about, which is doing a lot more experimenting, a lot more pilot project and prototyping and seeing what works and then building up from it, rather than these, you know, what we do is we have these grand ideas and then we essentially then put them out there and then they become too big to fail.
Well, let's look at a grand idea. Ken Livingstone's congestion pricing in London. Most people would call it a big success. When it was proposed for New York, it was shot down and everybody was screaming their heads off.
Yeah, I mean, that is an example where we highlight that in the book, the hard work that Mayor Livingstone did. And it's interesting because, again, this was a left-wing, almost socialist mayor who used a very market-oriented reform, using price mechanisms and charging people to go downtown London. And he embraced that reform because it had environmental goals that he thought were important. So it was a nice combination of two different ways of thinking. And he did it successfully. He took the risk of failure seriously, and he's instituted it. It had a lot of great effects in terms of reducing traffic and increasing travel speeds. And it is a little bit concerning that it's just difficult to win political support for that idea, because you're going to be charging people for something that historically has been quote-unquote free. And that is a very hard idea to sell politically and anywhere, really.
Does that fit into one of your seven traps?
Well, it's essentially congestion charging, which Mayor Bloomberg has, of course, proposed, and what they did in London. In many other cities, it's failed to get past what we call the Stargate, which is this point where you move from the political idea to the bureaucratic realm and implementation, and or it gets so distorted. Now, what Livingston did, first of all, he talked a lot about it in the campaign, and then he won, so he had a bit of a mandate where he said, and then his advisors basically afterwards, they said, you know what, don't do it. I mean, because the opposition was incredible. The Fleet Street papers were saying it was going to be a disaster, and they were all over him on this. But he said, you know, every once in a while, a politician has to take a risk for what's right. But they didn't only do that. What they did is they spent 18 months to 2 years actually going around to all the different stakeholder groups. You know, all the theater owners were originally really opposed to this because they were worried that people wouldn't drive back into London, the theater district, because they didn't want to pay the congestion charge, so they would lose business. And they had a lot of different businesses and others opposed to it. They went one by one. They worked things out. In some cases, they had to buy off a group or another, but they did that stakeholder work.
That's did they have the plan B in place?
They not only had plan B, but plan C, but plan D. They war gamed these things out for about 2 years, everything that could go wrong, nonstop scenario planning. They tested, they retested again. It was really amazing to watch it. We found that they actually did more of the war gaming there than we did for the aftermath of Iraq, you know, for a congestion scheme in a city. But they were successful in the end.
And it is a success now?
The day it was launched, so many things could have gone wrong, and it was very smooth sailing, and you ended up reducing congestion by about 30%. Now, congestion has creeped up again because they've put in bike lanes, and they've done a lot of other stuff to take some of the roads off the grid there, but generally, it did what it was supposed to do.
My guests are William D. Eggers and John O'Leary. Their book, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. It's published by Harvard Business Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's look at some of the other traps. The design-free design trap, what is that?
Well, that is when legislators design a piece of legislation to get passed, to get through what Bill calls the Stargate, to get it enacted, and fail to recognize that the main thing they're doing when they're writing a law is creating a blueprint that has to work in the real world. And the big example...
Sounds to me like healthcare right now.
Well,
right.
There is some concern that what's happening in healthcare today could fit that bill. The example we give is in California. In the late 1990s, they wanted to bring competition and choice to the electricity market, to reform the electricity market. They passed legislation unanimously. So this was a piece of legislation that was bipartisan. Everyone was on board with it. And within 2 years... they had rolling blackouts, cost $40 billion in consumer price hikes. Why? Because companies like Enron had figured out how to game the system, how to game the legislative design in a way that legislators had never anticipated. And that ended up completely undermining the design that they had launched, and it was a utter disaster.
Another example might be the repeal of Glass-Steagall, because we're still talking about what happened after all of those regulations were stopped?
Well, I mean, I think in general that whenever you have legislation that's going to involve, a lot of the marketplace in a certain area or another, there's going to be incentives to try to game that. We've seen that in student loans. We've seen that in vocational education. We've seen that in area after area is this gaming of the system. And what we say is that during the legislative design process, that's where you need to actually be doing simulations and war gaming and bringing those people in and acting it out to get a better sense of how people will try to game that system. But then you have to make a flexible enough design that you can fix that pretty quickly once it starts happening.
Another one of the traps is the Sisyphus trap.
Well, that's the trap.
That seems like everyone is a, yes. Almost all legislation is an uphill battle, isn't it?
Well, it's what we're talking about here is Bill and I have both worked in the public sector, and the myth of Sisyphus from Greek mythology, of course, is the fellow who's condemned to eternity to rolling a big boulder up a steep hill, and he never gets it up to the top. And for folks who have worked in government, it can often feel that way, that you are charged with this endless task. Whether you're the police in New York City trying to constantly fight against crime, it can feel difficult, and you also are always battling not only against trying to get the rock up the hill, but you know the hill is steeper in the public sector. The bureaucracy and the rules and the lack of incentives for doing the right thing. There are a lot of factors that make the public sector more discouraging in a lot of cases. And we talk about the need and the importance of the attitude and the sense of confidence and pride, really, within those workers who are trying to roll the rock up the hill in order to get success. And we think of this book in a lot of ways as trying to be a roadmap to take us from a government that we are so cynical towards and disappointed with, that can't seem to tie its own shoe correctly, to restoring a sense of pride in a government that can accomplish what it sets out to do and that we can all feel better about, including those who work within government. I mean, we need, I think we see the failures of government, and we oftentimes transfer that anger to those who are in government, and we need to separate the two. A lot of great folks in government trying to do good stuff.
Of course, not just in the United States. There's a great Japanese film by Kurosawa called Ikiru, yes, about people wanting to have a park in their neighborhood, and every government bureaucrat turns them away and sends them to another bureaucrat, and they keep on going around in circles. And one man who realizes he's going to die of stomach cancer actually gets the park through, and after he dies, at his wake, all the politicians who have been obstacles take credit for the park, and and they take all the credit away from him. But meanwhile, we finally have gotten the park.
Right. No, you know, as we say in the book, that behind all of these great initiatives that we've seen, the successful ones, there's always that kind of career public servant who's been the one that actually made it happen and got it done, who knew where all the bodies were buried, who knew how to, you know, work the machinery of government.
And that leads us to the silo trap.
Yes, the silo trap is essentially the problem that you very often have. You can look at it two ways. The first way is simply that, think about the intelligence failures before 9/11, right? And you've got 16 intelligence agencies and, you know, a lot of analysts in each one and a lot of noise coming out. Well, they weren't talking to each other. The FBI wasn't talking to the CIA and so forth and so on. And so you had a lot of information going up in silos, but it wasn't going across. This is such a big problem in government today between state and local governments and so forth. We saw this also with Iraq. I mean, with Katrina, certainly. And between state, local, federal government. So we need to fix that point. The other thing about the silo trap is that simply you have legislators who are looking at their piece of this journey to success, which is just getting a law done. You have bureaucrats who are just looking at implementation. You have other people, think tanks, who are doing the ideation. But you have no one looking at the whole journey and taking ownership of it.
And the complacency trap, the last of them, involves conditions changing fast but democracy moving slowly.
Well, a lot of the challenges that we explore in the book are rooted in the essential characteristics of democracy, separation of authority, the need to have public input on things. And with respect to the complacency trap, what that means is that anytime you have an existing structure in which there are existing employees, existing companies with contracts, existing beneficiaries of any kind of activity, people who like things the way things are, they actually become a tremendous barrier to change. And probably the best example of that is in urban education. It's an area that everyone points to in whether it's Chicago or Washington, D.C. or New York City or wherever. And it has become a constant struggle to try to make real change to improve the circumstances in urban public education, and that the barriers to change are very, very big. And we tell the story of Katrina, where since Hurricane Katrina essentially wiped out the school system in New Orleans, and the state legislature set up a situation where they created something called the Recovery School District, which all the old rules, the school board, the contracts, everything was gone, and it really set up a free approach. There have been more academic gains in the New Orleans school system in the past 4 years than there have been in the previous two decades.
But still, we have about a minute left, and it's my sense that if everyone in government read this book, they'd all nod their heads and say, absolutely true, oh boy, they're right on, and then nothing would change.
Well, I think that you have to have we believe that the future is ours to shape collectively, and that the inspirational examples from our past, and even from our not-so-distant past, 1996 welfare reform, etc., I think if people are aware of the process and they're aware of the traps in a new way, that we can actually consciously change our behaviors, consciously change some of the systems and structures that we have in place so that we can greatly improve the likelihood of success. I can't disagree with your point in the sense that it's possible also that we're going to continue along a political and a self-interested approach with poor results. But I think that when
even
you look
more
at,
now with the kind of polarization we're seeing,
polarization,
even on this, you know, on every level of government in the United States.
But one of the differences today is we've both been doing government reform for over 20 years. We've probably combined 45 years between us, and we have all these technology tools today, that social media tools that allow us to actually reach out to a diversity of views, to reach out to citizens, to bring more people into this process in a way that we just unconceivable before. We need to use those tools to help us to change this process.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today. I've been speaking with William D. Eggers, Global Director of Deloitte's Public Sector Research Program, and John O'Leary, a research fellow at the Ash Institute at the Harvard Kennedy School. Their book is called If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Big Things Done in Government. It is published by Harvard Business Press. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you
so much,
Leonard.